Nebenstimmen. A podcast by Ensemble Modern. Nebenstimmen brings you conversations on music, art and life between ensemble members and conversation partners chosen by them. Find out what the musicians are working on at the moment and what their personal thoughts are.
Welcome back to Nebenstimmen. I'm Paul Cannon, bassist of Ensemble Modern, and I'm joined today by the conductor, composer, and my fellow American, Brad Lubman. Brad, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Paul. Great to be here, as always.
You are a very regular guest of the Ensemble Modern as a conductor, and you are also, since many years, a professor of conducting at the Eastman School of Music in Rochester, New York. And it's very often that you're coming as a conductor, but I think for the first time we got to see you as a teacher last year in the context of our International Composer and Conductor Seminar, where we have five young composers come and write new pieces for the ensemble, and we have two young conductors working with the ensemble, and you were there as a coach.
Right.
So I want to go straight off the bat and ask, what is your general approach as a conducting teacher? What are you looking for in a student? What kinds of things do you tend to focus on?
In my teaching, you know, I don't see that teaching is a separate thing from the professional world of being a performer in any way. Everything that I do academically, meaning at Eastman or if I'm coaching something, you know, here, is based on what I've done in the professional world. Mm. And in fact, I tend to be very, I hate to say practical and pragmatic, because then that makes it seem as if I don't believe in artistry and musicality and poetry and philosophy, but that's not true. I believe in all of it. And I believe that with, for example, with instrumental playing or with singing, part of what we're doing is technical. It's scientific. What I always say is this, is if you cannot play in tune, or if you have trouble in certain positions as a string player, you have trouble playing accurately, all the philosophy and poetry and all the ruminating in the world is not going to help your Bach performance. So, so it is with conducting, and I do. And you've hit on a very sensitive subject. no, because I do feel that conducting has, I don't want to say evolved, and I don't even want to say de-evolved. I think conducting has morphed into something that it wasn't intended to be, and I mean that in a general. I'm just talking about if you look at the world of conducting. I don't mean, you know, orchestral versus new music versus, I just mean in general. And my feeling is always that the function of conducting is that we need to be there for the musicians and the music. Sometimes what the musicians need is more important than what the music might need. But it seems to me that in a lot of areas of conducting, we've gotten to a place where I think a lot of people, whether they're in the business or they're critics or whatever, they are looking at conductors for the physical, over-the-top, I would even go so far as to say maybe Hollywood kind of, you know, what do they look like?
Right.
And I don't want to go on too much length about the subject, but basically I do feel that I'm in a different line of work from what conducting has become. And I don't mean just because, oh, new music, it's got to be more technically precise or something like that. No, I mean all conducting. Mm. What I believe conducting is supposed to be, I look at it and I feel kind of like I'm in some sort of a minority.
But then you're talking about this discussion of style versus substance.
Or technique versus something else that people think is more. I mean, I know young conductors who have gone to conducting workshops and they've come back and they've told me that it was sort of, you know, beaten in, no pun intended, drummed into them. Don't be clear. The orchestra doesn't need you to be clear. Don't beat time. You can't be musical if you beat time. Never conduct staccato. That was something that somebody told me. Uh-huh. And it's, You know, yes, if you're conducting a world-class orchestra that has played the Beethoven, Brahms, Mahler, Tchaikovsky symphonies 4 million times, it's true that they may not need you to always beat time. But what I'm convinced of is what they don't need is for the person on the podium to all of a sudden stop conducting at all, stop beating time in any way, shape, or form, sort of look off into the distance as if they're a scared woodland creature hearing a sound in the forest or whatever. They start rehearsing by saying things that really have nothing to do with the music at hand. They're trying to be philosophical and poetic. And then it becomes a thing of, well, the audience is like this person because they look hyperactive or whatever it is. And it's gone away from what I think functional and musical conducting should be. But I also feel that there's a part of it which has to be inspired and has to be theatrical. But by theatrical, I don't mean over the top, you know, gesticulating and doing things that are unnecessary. So anyway, but that should be for a podcast on conducting, I think.
Well, I want to circle back to, because that's a very interesting question. So I think I'm going to circle back to that that topic a bit later on.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it was interesting for me to watch you in your element, so to speak, of coaching and teaching. And it got me really wondering, how does one begin a career as a conductor? And specifically in your case, how did you get your start?
Well, the first thing I just want to comment on, it's interesting you say my element. I don't consider myself an academic. I don't consider myself a teacher, actually. I don't consider that my element. When I feel like I'm in my element, it's when I am rehearsing, any ensemble. It could be orchestra, it could be new music ensemble. Yes, in the academic realm, but mostly in the professional realm. That's where I see myself.
But I feel the same way with double bass. I'm not a double bass professor exactly.
Right.
We have our academy here. I teach some bass from time to time, definitely. Right. But I'm also in my element. If people want to ask me a bunch of questions
exactly.
about bass, I'm very happy to do that.
Right. Okay. So it's an element of many elements. But I only say that because there was a time in my life that I was vehemently opposed to being in an academic position. I had the chance earlier on where I had an academic position, and then after 5 years of that, I vowed I would never go back. Never. But you know. But then there were reasons why I agreed to apply to the job at the Eastman School of Music. It was sort of out of
practical. When was that?
So that was in 1995. I got a call 95. Out of the blue, right? I was on faculty before that at SUNY Stony Brook from 90 to 95. I was the head of the graduate orchestra, and I think I was probably only about 27 years old. So I was the same age as many of the students. In fact, in some cases, the students were older than I was. So that was strange. But that's why I say, you know, my element, I think that I've had to work at figuring out how to teach conducting. I'm a very visually oriented person. I tend to learn things by observing and doing. You know,
But take me back a bit farther.
Yeah.
How did you actually get started?
So I'm getting
conducting.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm getting at that. Now, what's interesting is today's date is the 7th of December. The 6th of December is a very important date for me because in 1981, on December 6th, I conducted for the first time in public. I was a sophomore in college, so that's second year, you know, student. And I had the dream of conducting. I thought about conducting. I was obsessed with it. I don't know why. I can't remember why. Since I was about 14 years old, all right? So you have to imagine that my 3 years of high school, the last 3 years in the States of the public school system as high school, I bought many records. This would have been the late 1970s. I watched orchestral performances on TV. I went to orchestral performances. For example, Zubin Mehta had just taken over as music director of the New York Philharmonic. We would sometimes go to Tanglewood in the summer. I would watch Ozawa, watch them on TV. And I practiced conducting in front of a mirror. And I based a lot of my technique on what I was seeing Ozawa and Mehta do. My first year in college, I tried to start a reading orchestra because I thought, I better see if I can do this, you know? So I put up a sign on the main bulletin board. I'd like to start a reading orchestra of repertoire. And I wrote out, you know, flutes, oboes, clarinets, the whole list of the orchestra. You know,
you put together your own orchestra.
It didn't exist. No, three people signed up. Yeah, of course. So with embarrassment, really, I was kind of like, oh boy, I'm such an idiot. I took the sign down and I thought, you know, maybe it's not meant to be. All right. Mm-hmm. Next year, my second year in college, I was the desire to try conducting was so burning within me. I happened to speak with one of the oboists during an orchestra break. I said, you know, I really want to see if I can actually conduct. I tried to start a reading orchestra last year. Only 3 people signed up. This oboist said, all string players out there, you'll forgive this. The oboist said, well, string players don't want to do extra playing, but wind players do. And I want to do the Dvorak wind serenade. How about I find half the ensemble if you put together the other half, which for me was a blessing because I was unbelievably shy and I felt terrible, egotistical, that I would go to somebody and say, would you play the Dvorak wind serenade I want to conduct? So if she was going to find half the group, I would find the other half that I could manage. I don't remember how many rehearsals we had. Maybe we rehearsed during the course of a month or something like that. What I do remember vaguely was the very, very first rehearsal. So now here I was, for the first time in my life, not conducting in front of a mirror, conducting human beings. And my memory of it is that we started the Dvorak wind serenade. Maybe I let them play 8 to 15 bars. I don't remember. It was very good. And I stopped and I said something like, you know, hey, everybody, wow, it's really going well. It sounds great. It's a little bit slower than my tempo. So if you can just, you know, stick with me, follow my beat and play the short notes shorter. And 43 years later, it's kind of the same thing, you know. It's like, you know, hey, that's going really, really well, you know.
What if it was better?
Play the short note shorter. No, but the thing was that my point was this, is that I wanted to see if I actually had the ability to conduct, because I thought, and I really mean this absolutely sincerely, this is what I thought to myself. If it turns out that I'm no good at this, I think I probably thought to myself colloquially, if it turns out that I suck, if it turns out that I'm no good, I'll just stick with being a percussionist. I wanted to do that anyway. Turns out it went well, and I've never stopped conducting since then. That's really kind of the story. I don't have a degree in conducting. When I finished my undergrad degree, I was a percussionist. I thought, well, I should get a master's degree, maybe as a conductor. Let me audition for 2 schools, which I did. I only chose 2 schools. I didn't get past the first round, and this was the one and only time I ever made a career plan. I thought to myself, okay, I don't need a degree in conducting. Boulez doesn't have one. Toscanini didn't have one. I just continued to conduct. I had a little new music ensemble with some friends, so I was doing some conducting there. I was freelancing in New York City as a percussionist. I started doing that literally only a few months after I finished my undergrad degree. I just happened to get a call for something. That led to other gigs. There I was, freelance percussionist in New York. And a few years after that, not that many years, little new music ensembles, some which don't exist anymore, in New York, they started to call me. Hmm. Word got out, hey, this guy does new music, you know. So that's how that all started. There are other things along the way, other details, you know. I did go to Aspen for 2 summers in the conducting program. I did a couple of master classes in conducting with Pierre Boulez along the way. Then came the job at SUNY Stony Brook. I had been a percussion master's student at Stony Brook. The job of orchestra conductor, I applied for that job. I got that job. I did that from 1990 to 95. I then left, or actually my contract was not renewed, which for me was a absolute blessing because I didn't want to be there. You know, and I didn't want to quit. I didn't want to like burn any bridges and quit. I just figured, you know what? Let's see what happens. I don't think they're going to reappoint me. And they didn't. And that was great news for me. Inside, I was like, all right, great. Now I can go on and you know, start my life. And then what happened was I had very few gigs. Things were not going the way I had planned. And the Eastman School of Music called me out of the blue, the director. This would have been in 1995, to say, you know, we have a job opening, the Musica Nova Ensemble, the new music group. We're looking for, we're having a job search. And I was getting ready to say to the director of the school, I was getting ready to say, thanks, but no thanks. I had 2 other institutions approach me by a letter, by mail, Cincinnati Conservatory and the Minnesota University. You know, we would like you to apply for the position of director of orchestras and orchestral conducting. Now, in 1995, there was no email. So I typed as fast as I could and sent the letter, thanks, but no thanks. So now here I am on the phone with the director of the Eastman School of Music, getting ready to say to him, thanks, but no thanks. But because part of me is very pragmatic and I'm very practical-minded, as this director is talking to me, I thought, okay, look, I have friends who went to Eastman in the 80s. I know it's a great school. What happens if a year from now I have nothing going on? I will be kicking myself that I didn't apply for this job.
Sure.
So also, if I was expected for my first marriage, I have two daughters, and so we were expecting our first child. I thought, my God, you know, imagine if I have no work. So I said, yes, I'm interested. And they said, send your materials up, and we're going to get you up here somehow. They never called me. So after a few months, I called the search committee director, and I said, you know, the director of the school called me personally and said, apply. And they said, it was very awkward. Oh, I'm sorry. We've already chosen our candidates.
Okay.
So I was like, you see, academia is no good. You know. Anyway, a year later, they called me again. Search didn't go well. They didn't like anyone. Am I still interested? Now, of course, I had a six-month-old daughter. You know, yes, I'm still interested. And now the director of the school said, get out your date book right now. Let's choose a date. And so in October of 96, I went up there for 2 weeks, rehearsed the new music ensemble. And in February of 97, I was offered the job. So that job is director of Musica Nova and teach. There are two sort of classroom levels of conducting, the intermediate and the advanced level.
Mm-hmm.
And so in August... A month, was it a month after? So I came to Ensemble Moderne for the first time in June of 97.
So that was actually my next question. Was,
and then I moved to Rochester 2 months after that.
Okay, so it was really at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to hear about this because, of course, it was before my time.
Yep.
Your first time coming to Ensemble Moderne.
Yep.
Do you remember what project it was?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, I could say that, but there's a wonderful, you know, what do you call that? Synergy, which is funny because Synergy Vocals was on that project. But synergy in life, or is it coincidence, or is it fate of things coming together? Just a quick story that leads up to my first time with Ensemble Moderne. I'm going to give you this brief synopsis as possible. I worked at the Tanglewood Music Festival in the summers of 1989 to 94. I was the assistant conductor to composer-conductor Oliver Nussen and one of the staff conductors for the Festival of New Music. 94 was to be my last summer there because I wanted to do more than just new music. And they were not willing. They were like, no, this is what the job is. So I said, well, then this is my last summer, hoping that they would offer me other things. And they said, well, we're sorry to see you go. It's been great working with you. So anyway, but you know, one door closes, the other one opens. That summer, because the guest composer was Louis Andriessen and the guest conductor for new music was Reinbert Deleu, they brought in the Bang on a Can All-Stars.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, two of the three directors of Bang on a Can, Julia Wolf and Michael Gordon, were there during that week. They saw me conduct a concert with the students that included an early piece of David Lang's and Edgar Varèse's Intégrale. And that was the two things I did on the concert. I then was, during intermission, looking for a place to sit. Two people come up to me, introduce themselves. It's Julie Wolf and Michael Gordon. And I said, wow, it's great to meet you. And they said, that was fantastic. We loved, you know, that Varèse was amazing. And they said, Bang on a Can is going to start a chamber orchestra in New York. We want you to be the conductor. I said, that's amazing. To whom do I send my resume? They said, no, don't send anything. We've just decided just now.
We just hired you. Okay.
We just hired you based on how you did David's piece, the Lang piece, and the Varèse. So that was summer of 94. January of 95, the Bang on a Can Chamber Orchestra, which, by the way, was called Spit. We make our debut. I do the concert. At the end of the concert, this is in New York City, everybody's leaving, saying goodbye to friends and family. Michael Gordon comes over to me and he goes, hey, Steve Reich was at the concert. I mean, I nearly fainted. I said, what? He goes, in fact, he's still here. He wants to meet you. Okay. So I go and I meet Steve Reich and he's, you know, wow, I'm so impressed. It was really great. Oh, you're conducting. I might have something for you. I'll give you a call at some point. The next morning he called me. I think he woke me up, you know, and he goes, look, once again, great job. How would you like to do the New York premiere of a new piece of mine called City Life with my group, Steve Reich and Musicians, at Alice Tully Hall next year. That would have been February of 96. Yes, great. February comes. We're at the first rehearsal of City Life, which had been premiered already, you know, here. And we come to the first break, coffee break. Okay, everybody, let's take 20 minutes. Steve comes over to me and says, how'd you like to record this for Nonesuch? Oh my God, yes. He goes, hey, everybody, take out your daybooks. We're going to record City Life for Nonesuch. Great. Then he tells me that he's working on a new piece, a commission from Ensemble Moderne, a multimedia piece, and he's going to recommend that they engage me. And that's how we get to June of 1997. The piece was his second video opera called Three Tales. It was not completed yet, so we only had about 8 minutes of the piece.
Okay.
But the other thing, and this is for you music history buffs out there, that concurrent with the beginnings of Three Tales in June of 97 was his landmark piece, Music for 18 Musicians, was being played for the first time by a group other than his ensemble, and that was Ensemble Moderne.
Right.
So I was here to help out with that. I remember he said, look, you know, help coach, do whatever.
Well, and that was a big process, right?
With big that process.
That, because for his ensemble, it wasn't really notated.
That's right.
So this was basically a new score of an old piece.
It was a new score, right. And there's a whole story behind that. But so I was here to help coach that. I was here to conduct what was the first 8 minutes of Three Tales. And because Three Tales was not complete, they added that piece called Eight Lines, which I was conducting. And that's how I got here, you know, and that was in June of 97. And then in August of 97, I moved to Rochester, New York, and started my position at Eastman, you know, and the rest is history.
Right. Well, you've done quite a lot of programs in the meantime, both with us, but also with many orchestras and other ensembles. I mean, if I just read your bio, you've been pretty much everywhere, as far as I can see.
I have. You know, Europe has become sort of a second home. I mean, people say, where are you based? I say, usually on a plane between you know, Rochester and someplace in Europe, which I love because I love traveling. Mm-hmm. But I love traveling in Europe. I love working with the different orchestras and ensembles. It's really something that I feel very, very blessed and lucky to be able to do, and that I am still in good health, that I can still do it, you know.
I wanted to ask your thoughts about this week's program.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know when this podcast comes out. It could be that the podcast is coming after the concert's already done and gone, but it's still, I think, a very interesting program. And it's interesting at first glance, because as I'm looking at it, these are mostly not new pieces. These are what we would probably say are some gems from the late 20th century. So we have Sarajevo's Lichtbogen from 1986. We have Ferniehaus' La Chute du Car, the clarinet concerto from 1988. We have Wolfgang Riem, Geachte Form from 1996. And then maybe you could say it's an overlooked piece, but from Klaus Ostwald, the Second Chamber Symphony from 2006. So that's maybe one generation after. But I know that you're someone who's particularly passionate about that time period of music from, let's say, 1950, 1960 to around the turn of the century.
Yes.
So I'm curious for you what this kind of program is representing.
What's the song? These are a few of my favorite things.
Right.
So, you know, the way this program came about is, you know, the ensemble asked me, and it was Christian Fausch, you know, are you available for this? The main piece is going to be this piece of Klaus Ostwald. Now, coincidentally, I didn't know the music of Klaus Ostwald until, I'm pretty sure it was around the time of the pandemic. I happened to come across a CD of his on the Vergo label. There were three big pieces. And I don't remember how I came across. Sometimes I just, you know, you read things, you hear a name, whatever. And I listened to this piece and I immediately liked what I heard. I was like, how is it that I don't know this composer, you know? This is somebody whose work should be played more often. So when I was approached to do this program, it was basically this Klaus Ostwald piece, the Second Chamber Symphony. So I thought, oh, fantastic. I get to actually do a piece by this composer whose work I only recently discovered and whose work interests me. I was then, now very often for the past 40 years or whatever it's been, very often the program has already been devised and I'm asked, are you available for the concert? Here's the program. once in a while I might be asked, oh, do you have a suggestion? We need a little 10-minute piece, you know, on the second half or like that. It's rare that I'm involved with putting something together, you know, from scratch, from the very beginning, which is okay with me. I've said yes to so many programs, and I've gotten to learn so much repertoire. I've gotten to work with so many different composers, and somehow that works well for me, you know. But it sometimes feels a little bit weird that I'm almost never asked, hey, here's this concert date. What'd you like to do? So with this, it was Klaus Ospald. What else might we do? So I gave a list of names of composers that I was interested in at the time, or I've always been interested to do. And certain things, it was either, oh, we've done a lot of this composer, or we're not really looking in that direction. How about, and so it was suggested, this Sarajevo piece, Lichtbogen, which is a wonderful piece. It's the first piece of hers I ever heard. Mm-hmm. My first summer at Tanglewood, 1989. I had never heard of her before. Of course, in those days, you know, it's always hard to explain to a younger generation of people what it was like when there was no internet. Mm-hmm. You know, there was nothing. You know, you news traveled slowly. You know, so here I was hearing this name, Sarajevo. I didn't know, you know, who it was, and I was not conducting the piece, but I remember hearing it in the performance. And what's this new thing called live electronics? You know, this was
right.
It was so amazing and so new. And I was fascinated by this piece of hers. I've had the opportunity to do it many times since then, and I love Kai's music very, very much. So I said, oh, that's wonderful. Then the idea was, let's take, you know, we did that all Fernihau program in Tokyo in 2022. Let's do La Chute d'Icare, you know.
Yeah, I mean, our clarinetist, Jan Bossier, I don't know how many hours he's spent banging his head against the wall learning this piece. So, you know, that happens so often on our side, and I'm sure that happens to you all the time, that you spend so much time on a very difficult piece only to play it once somewhere,
yeah,
never again.
Yeah, I know.
So any chance you can find to bring these things back.
Exactly. And I thought that was a wonderful idea also because of that, because it's like, you know, we worked so diligently on that. It was an all Fernihau, you know, program. And it's nice, even though I love doing new things, it's nice to be able to do something again, to go back to something, because sometimes you discover things that you didn't notice the first time around, but also it's just good to keep certain pieces in circulation. So yes, great idea. So we have Klaus Ospald, we have Kaija Sarajevo, we have Brian Fernihau. What else might I suggest? And I did something that I rarely do. So as a composer, a lot of people don't know that I compose. A lot of that is because I'm not good at self-promotion to begin with, but there came a point early on in my conducting career that I thought, I don't want to force my music. I don't want to be known as, if you engage him as a conductor, oh boy, he's going to want to do his own music. Mm-hmm. So I kept really quiet about it for a really long time.
It's funny because sometimes it's the opposite problem with composers who want to conduct.
Right.
I mean, sometimes that's amazing. If you have a George Benjamin or an Enno Poppe in front of you, fantastic.
Exactly.
Every time. Yes, every time.
Yes.
But sometimes it's a composer who really shouldn't be doing it.
Exactly.
You never know.
Right. So
I haven't heard your piece yet, but I'm really excited to hear it. It's called To Quiet the Mind.
Yes.
Written last year, right?
No, it was premiered last year. It was premiered in Chicago by the Grossman Ensemble. They commissioned the piece. So a year ago, I think it was October 1st of 2023, so it was written in early 2023. Maybe I started it in end of 22, 23, something like that.
Right. So it's by far the newest piece on the program.
That's correct, yeah.
And it's a European premiere, is it?
This will be the European premiere.
Fantastic.
Right. Yes.
Well, I'm happy. Happy to do it.
I'm elated, you know.
There's no double bass. That's my only criticism.
I'm sorry, but you have to understand, I would have included one, but the Grossman Ensemble, when they commission pieces, it is a fixed instrumentation.
Yeah, sure.
And you have to use each of the instruments. You can't say, I don't want to use harp or French horn. It's like...
Oh, they're straight. Good for them.
Yeah. But yeah, they've amassed a very, very nice... a lot of new pieces because they've been around, I think, for well over 5, 6, 7 years. You know, anyway, that's why there's no bass. Otherwise, there would be.
but what can you tell me about the piece? About the content of the piece?
Yeah. So the piece, which is 10 minutes, because that was also part of the commission, had to be a 10-minute piece. when I started to think about the piece, I thought about a piece that starts with very virtuosic, fast music. Now, I happen to like complex music. I like dense music. I like things that are active and fast. And so that's kind of a feature of a lot of my pieces, except for a period in the mid-90s where I was so influenced by Feldman that I have a number of pieces which are very Feldman-esque. Otherwise, though, I like density. I like complexity. So there I was thinking about how the piece might unfold. In the meantime, I had some things that I was working on during the pandemic that either were in a piece that never came to fruition or they were just materials. And I said, well, I want to use this stuff, so let me see. I had to repurpose some things. I had to rework it. Not sure, is this going to work out? And slowly but surely, the piece started to evolve, but not starting out with this fast, virtuosic music. It started out with this very sort of meditative, quiet, still music. And that's how the piece kept evolving. And I thought, well, because I know the people in the Grossman Ensemble for whom the piece is written, I don't know all of them, but I knew many of them, and I want to have some music which is indeed fast and virtuosic. But here I was about, was I six, a 10-minute piece, and I'm already about 5 minutes in or whatever it was, and it's this absolute still kind of meditative thing. So I thought, I better start writing fast. What would happen? I'm sorry, not what would happen. What would it be like, this virtuosic fast music? So I kind of, I put aside the part of the composition that was already developed and about 4 or 5 minutes long, and I started in with this fast stuff, which is derived from some of the earlier music somehow. I don't remember how, because I don't do sketches. I don't keep sketches. Mm-hmm. I work directly into the score. But anyway, so I said, okay, so now I have an idea of what the fast virtuosic music is going to be, and that took off, and I think I composed most of that ending section, and then I thought, I need a bridge now. I need to get from this slow, meditative, music into the fast stuff. And I came up with that, and then there's a little sort of a coda thing. And then I thought, well, this is such an opposite piece for me, When I premiered the piece, I spoke to the audience about it, and the ensemble wanted me to tell the audience a descriptive thing that I did to the ensemble. I said, the fact that this piece lives or exists in this meditative, slow state for so long, which is about 6 minutes or so before it goes into the fast stuff, I said, it's kind of the opposite of how I am. And I call it sort of the first date syndrome, that when I was dating, which I was never really successful at, I was the person who, in that first date, I wanted to share every bit of information, what's this, what's that? Oh, you like that? I like that too. What's your favorite color? I'm really into that. I was unable to be cool, calm, and collected. Mm-hmm. It's just not, that's not me. And they said, oh, you should, when you speak to the audience, you should talk about that. Call it, first date syndrome. So I said, that tends to be how my music is. It is like the first date syndrome where you're expressing so many thoughts hyperactively. And this piece does the opposite. This piece is absolutely, that's why I call it To Quiet the Mind.
That's the title. Right.
Yeah.
Got it.
I'm not a practitioner of Zen. I'm not a practitioner of anything like that. But when I was like 19 or 20 or so, I was introduced to concepts of Zen from a friend of mine, and it had a profound impact on me. I did a lot of reading in my 20s in about Zen and things like that. And there is something Zen-like, I hope, that's in the back of my mind and my being in relation to everything that I do. And so the idea of To Quiet the Mind, to me, describes how the music proceeds. But then one can say that when there's that, in a way I'm giving away the piece, but when it changes towards the end of the piece, when it changes, one might think, well, we have to quiet our mind again. Because, okay. Yeah.
I want to pick your brain a little bit. So this, as I mentioned, this program that we're doing this week, it's quite focused on some of the older classics of the modern music or contemporary classical music, whatever you want to call it. First of all, I'm curious, at what point is it no longer modern? At what point is it no longer contemporary?
tomorrow.
are these pieces still relevant today in the way that they would have been when they were premiered?
Yeah, that's a good question.
And maybe you've premiered so many pieces yourself, and you continue to premiere a lot of pieces.
Yes.
And I'm curious, in relation to those older pieces from your own student times or even before then, until today, what kind of developments have you been tracking? What kind of trends have you noticed?
Right. We should. I just wanted.
It was a lot of questions. Excuse me.
No. But no, it's great. But there's one thing. So there was a piece that was added to the programs as a in memoriam of Wolfgang Riem, who sadly passed away earlier this year, and that's Gejagte Form, which is one of my favorite pieces.
Right.
And I had the great pleasure to do it with Ensemble Moderne in 2006 when we premiered Helmut Lachenmann's Concertini. So it holds a special place in my heart. And so now to get to the question, some of the pieces. You know, people talk about the classics of the repertoire, whether you're talking about Beethoven Eroica or the Rite of Spring or, you know, just in general, Mozart and Brahms and all this sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And what I think many people don't know is that a lot of these pieces that they feel are masterpieces, whatever that word actually means, were not seen as such. And there's this wonderful book called A Lexicon of Musical Invective.
I've read that book.
Compiled by Nicholas Slininsky.
Slininsky, yeah.
Who, by the way, turns out was a cousin of mine. Second cousin four times removed. Yeah, my brother does a lot of genealogical research, and a few years ago he discovered that, you know, we would have been related. but in it, Slininsky compiles newspaper reviews, critics' reviews from the time of Beethoven to Schoenberg. And it's amazing to read some of the reviews. For example, of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, there's one paper, it's in the mid-1800s, saying, and I'm paraphrasing, but saying, "We have now heard Beethoven's Seventh Symphony many times, and in it we can detect no design, no connection amongst its parts. We would have called it even a hoax." This is Beethoven 7, you know?
Right.
Other critics talking about Brahms, the cerebral composer who was incapable of writing a melody. I mean, you know, so the idea, the illusion that, these were the great master composers, I mean, everything is relative. Now, I'm not saying that Beethoven and Brahms are not great composers. What I am saying, though, is think about how things are relative to their time. You know, the people who thought that the Rite of Spring was unplayable, or who thought that it wasn't music. You know, you can apply that to God knows how many pieces. And so some of the developments, some of the things I've seen, and this is amazing, is pieces that were once difficult or presented problems, either problems of intonation or problems of rhythm or whatever, you know, 20 years later, all of a sudden, everyone's able to play it. Just like you can do now with a good conservatory orchestra. You know, they can play the Rite of Spring probably better than many professional orchestras could in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. You know, it's just...
That's possible.
Yeah. It's just how things evolve. So I have seen, just in terms of performance abilities, you know, I have seen things get to a level where there have been now, it's more than just one generation, but a couple of young generations who are able to do things with greater ease than perhaps their teacher's generation or the teacher's teacher's, you know, generation. But in terms of compositional developments and such, I would say since approximately 1950, that's just it used to be that people would say music since 1945, you know, that was like the cutoff point. I mean, okay, we could say since 1945, 1950. The proliferation of musical styles is so overwhelming, but in a good way, and amazing. I mean, and I teach a course called Contemporary Repertoire at Eastman. This is for the conducting majors. And one of the things I'm trying to show them is look at how many different things, different styles. It's no longer like you have a tonality and then you have the people who want to go back to tonality. Or, you know, you have the post-European avant-garde and then you have the minimalists. You have so many different things now, which I think is wonderful. But I will tell you that where I stood as a young music student in the early 80s, and then when I was a young professional in the mid to late 80s, back then, I was a real sort of Boulez kind of a guy. You know, it was Boulez, Carter, Warnon, Volpe. That's new music. I didn't like minimalism. I didn't like people who were writing tonal or emotional music. I thought, no, that ended with Mahler and Sibelius, you know. So I saw it as a kind of continuum, you know, and that shouldn't we be going further or something like this? And then, thankfully, in the early 90s, I started to change. I started to become much more open-minded. I kind of rebelled against myself in a way, and I started to listen to things that I had heretofore ignored, like the music of Reich, Adams, Glass, Xenakis, Feldman, and I started to become much more open-minded. And over the years, it's been a long process, and it's one of the things that I actually make a point of telling the students is you need to work at becoming as open-minded as possible. And that might mean you have to go back to either certain pieces or certain composers and listen over and over and over again. Maybe give it a rest for a few months, maybe for a year or something, but go back to it, go back to the pieces. I'll tell you, with certain composers and certain pieces, it took me 25 years of on and on, off again. No, I don't like this. Oh, I think I like this. No, I'm never doing. Oh, now I had the chance to conduct some music. No, I don't like it. Yes, I like it. And eventually I found that I felt a connection and I was able to understand where the composer was coming from. But now what I think I'm seeing, and I will only know in a few years when we have some hindsight, is that there's a generation of people who don't want to know about music from a certain realm or music from a certain past. Or, you know, I sometimes ask, I'll say, doesn't this remind you of the Schoenberg Five Pieces for Orchestra, the third movement? Anybody know the piece? Now, I'm talking not with professionals, but with students. Mm. And you get there are a lot of holes in people's knowledge of repertoire.
Oh, but there's so much to know. Yeah. I mean,
it's true.
That's one of the hardest parts of being a music student is just how much repertoire. You have hundreds and hundreds of years to study. And
right.
If you don't know, okay, it's an important piece in some sense. That's true. But I'm not sure as a freshman in college if I would have known that piece.
No, of course not. But I'm talking about, you know, speaking to a room filled with juniors, seniors, and grad students. And mm-hmm. one of the things that's come up in conversation, and it's kind of what I surmised, is that even though now we have so much at our fingertips, you know, I mean, to the point that you can premiere a piece and the next day it's uploaded to YouTube. I mean, that happened to me.
That's scary. Yeah.
That happened. I premiered an Eno Popa piece, speaking of Eno's music, with the Vedea in Cologne. This is now going back to 2015. And the next day, I saw, it wasn't a video, it was audio. I saw YouTube. Eno Popa, Torf, world premiere. I said, but that's me. I just did that yesterday. And then I scrolled down, and it was from the broadcast. There was a live broadcast. Whoever this person was, they recorded it, and they uploaded it to YouTube. So the next day, you know, it was up. Available to all. And there's so much that's at our fingertips. So much music is available, whether it's from streaming platforms or YouTube or, you know, or people, you know, SoundCloud, Bandcamp, and nobody knows anything. I don't mean that literally, but they know less. And here's the reason why. It was said to me by one of the grad students. They said, you know, the whole point about learning more and more repertoire, they said, the problem is we don't know where to turn first. And I said, so you mean to tell me that it's no longer like, you should know these, you know, the nine symphonies of Beethoven or these sonatas of Beethoven, and you should know these symphonies by so-and-so. They said, yeah, there's no longer something that gives us a hint of what direction we should go in.
I don't know if I agree with that, but I do think it's important to let go of the embarrassment of not knowing a name. I think that's very important.
I agree with
because
you.
Because I mean, I've been in this business a while now. I've played a lot of pieces. I've met a lot of composers.
Right.
I've listened to a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And a week doesn't go by that I'm not confronted with, oh, you've never heard of this person?
Yeah. Oh, sure.
Are you stupid? You don't know this one? And that... At some point, you just get over it. There's too many names.
There's too many names,
and there's no need to be embarrassed. It's just cool.
Right
now, I know this one too.
Yeah, but the problem is confounded now with so. Okay, so I think when I was a, you know, when I was a teenager, whatever, getting into classical music, there was the Schwann record catalog, you know, and one could argue and say that, well, maybe that was limited, but it wasn't. It kind of showed you every record that was available, and
it was curated.
It was curated
in a way. I mean, when there's producers involved, there's record companies involved. Somebody's deciding who gets listened to.
Exactly right. RCA deciding that. Here's all you need to know about classical music. It's the NBC Symphony and Toscanini conducting. And you need to know the 9 symphonies of Beethoven, the 4 of Brahms, Tchaikovsky 4, 5, and 6. We don't think he wrote 1, 2, and 3. You know, like, you know, these Verdi overtures. It was curated, perhaps to a fault and too limited, but at least it gave people some direction. Now we don't have that. The other thing we don't have is there's a change in how music history is taught. I don't know if it's at every university, but I do know that it's become something in which they're no longer teaching like the timeline. You don't learn these are the representative things from the, you know, medieval and Renaissance and Baroque and classical and Romantic.
Chronological. Yeah.
It's chronological. It's not done that way. It's done based on topics. Music and politics, music and nature, music and, yeah.
Interesting.
And I have, and this you can broadcast, I have a huge problem with that. I really, really do. And one of the reasons is that whenever I learn something, I feel that it's important. I want to know the chronology. You know, there was one summer.
Context matters.
Context, exactly. There was one summer, and for some reason I happen to remember that it was 2015. I don't remember why. Where, you know, I happen to like a lot of jazz, a lot of different kinds of music that fall under that general label of jazz. And I'm a big fan of John Coltrane and Miles Davis, but I realized that there was a lot of music, a lot of albums of Miles Davis that I didn't know. And I read his autobiography, and I listened to every single recording that he ever made. It was a fantastic, not only just for educational reasons, but I was inspired and...
And you did that chronologically.
I don't know if I got to them chronologically, but then as I was putting together a playlist, I needed to know. What came out? Because I knew Kind of Blue, I knew Bitches Brew, I knew In a Silent Way, and there may have been one other one in the early 60s or so. I needed to go before Kind of Blue. That was the album that completely blew my mind. I needed to know, was this 1964 or 67? And and I'm like that. Let's say I'm getting to know, I can't think of a composer off the top of my head. I will tell you, recently I realized that I didn't know the year. I couldn't remember the chronology of Webern Cantata 1, 2, and the Orchestra Variations. And it really disturbed me, you know? And the string quartet. Because I want to know, did something influence something else? What came before? Right. What is something looking backwards? Was there a foreshadowing? I don't know. Maybe I'm just strange in that way. I always want to know. I'm like this with works of visual art. If I'm looking at a retrospective, let's say, of whoever it could be, de Kooning, Kandinsky, Jean Miró, whatever, I want to see the evolution. I need to know, did this come before that? Was this from the 1920s and this was from the 1940s? I don't know. And so I feel that it's important in terms of music history because I think it's important to know what influenced what. I remember reading about 3 years ago or so, there was a group that was forming that was going to do things like they're going to take fruit and squash it on a piece of manuscript paper, and wherever the fruit stains fall, those are going to be the notes. And you feel like saying, do you ever hear of Cage? Have you heard of Fluxus? Have you heard of... Now, maybe they did hear of it, but it's this almost idea that history doesn't matter and we're coming up with something new, you know, and...
Oh, the search for novelty. That's a very difficult thing because in order to truly come up with something new, you would have to know everything which has already happened, and that's not possible.
That's not possible.
So, of course, it can happen. You're going to come up with an idea, and you just reinvented the bus.
Exactly. I know.
Okay.
I know.
I want to circle back to that first question.
Yes.
That we started this whole talk with.
Yeah.
I just asked you about developments in composition from the 20th century to the 21st century.
Right.
Have you seen similar developments in conducting? From the 20th to the 21st.
Yeah, as I said, that's we need a separate podcast for this. Yes, I have. And I was alluding to it earlier on when I was talking about this, and I kept saying things like, don't even get me started on this subject. But so let's see. Let's see if I can sum up or encapsulate. So conducting. It's often been said that the father of the modern school of conducting was Sir Arthur Nikisch, you know, in the late 1800s, that he was maybe the first to be the sort that put his interpretation, and he had a way of apparently he was very hypnotic, mm-hmm. and people would play and they wouldn't even know why and how and all that. Okay, whatever. There were many composers who conducted, you know, not only Wagner and Mendelssohn and Berlioz, but, you know, of course, you got Strauss, and even Puccini conducted some, and Brahms conducted some, you know. And then there were the conductors who were perhaps more about the sort of meticulous preparation, and they were friends with the composer, and maybe they didn't imbue the work with some sort of personal, you know, will. And then you had people like, now I'm going to go from the late 1800s all the way into the early 1900s, into the 1930s, Wilhelm Mengelberg, who was, you know, known for really putting an enormous personal spin on things. You know, the same could be said of Furtwängler. You know, you had these conductors who were known for maybe not always being true to the letter of the score, you know, in a literal way, and maybe putting too much of their imagination in on the thing. But the one thing that was consistent from, of course, the late 1800s, we don't know because there's no film. So I'm talking about conductors where there's either good written description or there is film, was that conducting was not something that was supposed to call attention to itself. It was not about being histrionic. It was not about dancing around or doing some sort of visual, you know, reinterpretation of, you know, of Romeo and Juliet, or, you know, Mahler reliving his childhood, whatever. You know, you were there to help the musicians get through the piece. Now, in those days, a symphony by Brahms, and by those days, I mean late 1800s, early 1900s. Symphony by Brahms was very difficult to play. In fact, I remember
it still is.
It still is, I know. But the familiarity now, and the fact that many people, they know what are the tunes, what are the difficult things, when, you know, when am I the accompaniment? But even someone like great conductor, composer, educator Gunther Schuller, I remember him saying in a masterclass I heard in the early 90s at Tanglewood, he said that there was a time when the Brahms symphonies were really, really difficult repertoire, you know. And if you think about the conductors who were born in the late 1800s, Toscanini was born in 1867. That's 40 years only after Beethoven died. So he's right. Really of another time. But then a little bit later than that, you had Bruno Walter and Sir Adrian Bolt and Carl Böhm and all these people. For them to be conducting Brahms, that was new music. And I mean that like somebody nowadays conducting Rheim and Sarajevo and Infernia. So the orchestra needed help. I'm not saying that the musicians were terrible. I'm just saying that the idea of trying to sort out how do we get through the piece, how do we get through this, who has the important part, what's, you know, so the conductor was really there as a great enabler and organizer of things. All right, now you go further into the 20th century. And this started to be, as I said, there were the conductors like Mengelberg and Furtwängler who put more of their, let's say, imagination or beliefs and stretched things a certain way or distorted things a certain way. And there are those who worship. You know, there's some people out there who will only listen to recordings that are conducted by Furtwängler and Mengelberg, and that's about mm-hmm. it. but then what started to happen was it went beyond just the realm of interpretation or belief in what the composer's message was, and it started to go into the visual realm. Now, conducting was not meant to be a visual thing in the same way that, I mean, okay, famous example, Nathan Milstein, one of the great violinists of the 20th century, but I remember hearing a story that somebody said they told some friend of theirs, oh, Milstein is playing. Well, he's almost at the end of his career. You must go and hear it. And the person went to hear Milstein, and they were very bored. They didn't like it. And the person telling the story said, what are you talking about? This is one of the greatest violinists. He said, he didn't really seem to move around and do much.
Right.
You know? So there's that. There's that aspect. We've become a highly visual society. And yes, one could say that Bernstein was one of the people. Bernstein and von Karajan were largely responsible for that. But Bernstein was not trying to do anything other than communicate through gesture to the orchestra what he felt the music needed to do. He was not aware of his conducting. In fact, there's a video in which he says that when he was studying a tango with Koussevitzky, I think, the suggestion was to the students to conduct in front of a mirror. Bernstein tried it once and just was like, you know, laughing at himself. This is the stupidest thing in the world. And he never did it since then. So I'm convinced that Bernstein was not trying to start some sort of way of conducting that was highly visual. Von Karajan, on the other hand, and this is very interesting, von Karajan was very aware of technology, was very aware of the use of the media. And in the early 60s, he got really intrigued by the idea of film and filming of an orchestra and filming of the conductor. So what he did was he hired a pickup group in Berlin to record Strauss' Till Eulenspiegel. And they spent several hours recording it. And once they got the recording to be, you know, perfect or really, really good, he let the orchestra go. And for the rest of the day, he stayed in the studio with a film crew who filmed him, von Karajan, conducting to the recording. And von Karajan was getting behind the camera and saying, no, adjust this camera this way. No, this camera should be... And what's very interesting to me is if you look at his conducting from prior to this point, so there's films of him from the 1950s, Berlin Philharmonic, they're on tour in Tokyo, Brahms 1. He's using a longer baton than we're used to seeing. Yes, he still looks like von Karajan, but the gestures are somewhat different than from after this period, I think it was 1962, 63, where he filmed himself extensively. He starts to use, there's a smaller baton, there's much more of the von Karajan-esque flowy, you know, gestures. I think he became very, very aware of what he looked like. And I don't mean looks and then like the hair. I mean what his gestures, what his baton technique looked like. Now, this is a good thing, but it's a bad thing. It's always a double-edged thing. It always is, because you want, as a conductor, you want to enable the musicians to rise to the absolute peak of their abilities. As far as I'm concerned, may as well do it within the first 15 minutes of a rehearsal, the first half hour. Why not? Let's just get to where we know we're going to go. And doesn't mean you have to be at peak performance for the next 3 days, but let's just establish what is the level we're trying to get to. Now, if you can be clear, meaning that you have technique that enables the players to know what they need to do without asking millions of questions. You conduct in such a way that you're giving them the framework of the piece, you're giving them the scaffolding, the skeleton, whatever, and then they can pour into that the notes that they need to do. You do that in a clear way, a technical way, but you do it in a musical and an artistic way. You are then achieving some of the highest possible results in the shortest amount of time, A. B, you are enabling the orchestra and the ensemble. You're not getting in their way. C, you go in there and you entrust the musicians. You treat them with utmost respect. You have trust and you treat them with respect. And that's very easy to do if you have been a member of an ensemble in an orchestra. And I never forget what it's like, because as I said, I freelanced as a percussionist. I played for at least 5 years professionally. And I never forget what that's like to be on that side of the podium. But the school of thought of, you know, you have to inspire them. And it's not about being clear. And, you know, after all, look at Bernstein, look at von Karajan, look at, you know, Furtwängler, you know, these people with this unreliable technique. Von Karajan had very good technique, by the way. Klemperer was another one with strange technique. As if that's supposed to impart some very special message that you can. I mean,
it can, but first of all, it really depends on the piece.
Yes.
It also depends on how well the ensemble knows the piece.
Yes.
So I mean, if it's a new piece and it's quite complicated and intricate, then getting a weird, crazy, big gesture doesn't help at all.
It doesn't help.
And You know, I've been thinking about this a lot recently, like what makes a great conductor great? And I guess there's a lot of answers you could give.
There are.
And it's a big combination of things, of course.
Yes.
Musical skills, your ears, the communication and the rehearsal technique. But I think if I had to put something at the number one spot, I'd probably say confidence.
Mm.
And it's not necessarily the confidence of here I am, look at me.
No.
It's the confidence that you can impart by looking me in the eye and giving me a cue. And I know that if I play right now, I'm right.
Yes.
And that gives me as a player the confidence to just absolutely crush the thing.
Yes.
And that's something you do very well.
Thank you.
And I think that might be what you're talking about here. There's this kind of Instagram confidence of it looks to someone who doesn't know any better that this is a very confident person who's gesticulating wildly on the podium. Yeah.
But it doesn't help anybody.
But in the practical matters for the musicians, because there's very specific information, and I think most listeners don't realize exactly what a conductor does.
That's true.
But you know, for the performers, there's some very precise information in all of that gesticulating that we need.
Yes.
And the more complicated and intricate the piece, the more precise and clear that needs to be.
Exactly.
So that in a program like this, we're playing Ferniehau, for God's sake. We don't need somebody just jumping around.
And wasn't it interesting today, and I love when this happens, wasn't it interesting today that at...
In rehearsal,
at measure, I wish I could remember what it was, it's towards the end, towards the very, very end, where all of a sudden it gets very, very, very quiet. And as a bar of, and it's 16th note equals 88 or so, 86. And it's a bar of 216 and then 316 and then 516. And then we're on the last page and it gets very, very loud. It was the quiet thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we were rehearsing it and I was taking it apart and only rehearsing certain instruments and then blah, blah, blah. And then Christian Hummel, the fantastic oboist, said, he goes, but it's 216, 316. Yes, could it maybe be a little bit more rhythmic? which is so fantastic because I usually am not the sort of conductor that somebody would say, could you be more? And I said, oh, you mean to actually conduct rhythmically? And I said, oh, I was trying to be musical, you know, because it was very quiet and I was really focused on that. But I love that because then it just shows that, and this is not to, I'm not trying to prove that I'm right. It just shows that, yes, there are many times, I'm not saying all times, but there are many times in which our job as a conductor is we do need to provide rhythm and clarity. And it's not just being clear and not just being rhythmic. It's what kind of rhythm or what kind of, what is the manner or the feel or something like that, so that we can enable the musicians to do not only their utmost best, but to do what the composer is trying to get across.
Well,
so I rest my case.
I think on that note, we can call it a day. I might need to go practice now. Okay.
No. Time off is very important, I think. Even though, what did I say to several people? When'd you get here? I said, you know, I've had too much time off. I've had a couple of free days. I don't do well with time off. I don't do well. I couldn't wait to get here and start rehearsing. I got here early because I was coming from someplace else, and I had 2 days. And yes, it's very good. I can take more time to study, but it's too much free time. I don't do well with free time. I do well when I'm in gear. Yeah, you understand what I mean. Anyway.
Well, Brad, I'll see you tomorrow, and I want to thank our listeners for checking in on deep thoughts from Brad and Paul.
Yes, well, Paul, thank you for having me. It's always a great pleasure to chat with you. It's a great pleasure to work with you, too. I mean, that's, you know, you're just a phenomenal, phenomenal player, phenomenal musician. It's always such a pleasure, but also great when we have a chance to sort of, you know, chat about these things. So thank you for having me.
That was Nebenstimmen, a podcast by Ensemble Moderne.